So I think I'll begin by saying, here we are, we're these spiritual people in the Bay Area, tend to be liberal, and of course there's some wonderful things about that. We care about human rights and the environment and all that. In some ways we have values that are at least similar to the values of the hippies in the 60s, you know, not identical to, but... And it's intriguing, one criticism that the older generation had of the hippies is that they weren't very disciplined. Yes, they were about loving everybody and all these great ideals, but they weren't very disciplined. And so it's just an interesting question, on average, how disciplined are we? And how disciplined are we, you know, compared to, I don't know, other people who live right now? You know, I don't really know the answer. It's just an interesting question. Certainly, I think it's the case that we live in a time when it's hard to give our spiritual discipline a kind of priority, only because we all have very busy lives, and there are so many priorities in our lives, you know, and there's this way that capitalism just wants to be the priority in everyone's life, you know, and so it really takes tremendous effort to prioritize one's spiritual discipline. And it's funny, if you look at the original Buddhist writings, the Pali Canon, there's an incredible urgency in those writings. An urgency about practicing the Dharma, an urgency about meditation. They use these powerful metaphors. For example, teaching a group of people the proper Dharma, they use the metaphor, for example, children in a burning house, and someone coming and rescuing the children from the burning house. You know, an image of tremendous urgency, you know. And it's hard to find that kind of urgency in, you know, certainly in the New Age movement today, let's say. It's hard to find that kind of urgency. And there's one, I mean, there are many things going on there. I mean, one very curious thing to me just has to do with the length of human life. If you think about it, we live in a time when average life expectancy is, you know, 70s, 80s. You know, many people live into their 80s and 90s. This is very different from, say, 150 years ago. 150 years ago, all the time, children died, people died in their 20s and 30s and 40s. You know, if you made it to your 60s, you were really doing well. And of course, even then, America in the 19th century, that was a huge improvement over hunting and gathering society, so most of human history. And so we live in a time when we're living much, much longer than most humans in most human history have lived in the history of our species. Well, fact number one that's kind of interesting is absolutely nobody's grateful about that. No one's amazed by that. Everyone just takes it for granted. You know, so that's interesting fact number one. But it also, I think, as wonderful as it is, it gives us some bad habits in the way that we think about time. We think that we have a lot of time, and we think that we have a lot of time for our spiritual practice. Oh, I don't need to fix this bad habit now. I have plenty of time to fix this bad habit, you know, this sort of thing. And there's some problems with thinking that way. Problem number one is, you know, even if I did, like, intense spiritual work from the age of 20 to, say, the age of 95, not really, there's nothing really guaranteeing that I would get anywhere, you know, that I would really be able to actualize any kind of goal that I wanted to actualize, even over all that time. It's also true that it's just the nature of habits. The longer we have a habit, the more roots it develops. Anything that we do day after day after day, grows deep roots. And so this whole idea of, oh, I won't fix this bad habit now, I'll wait. Anytime we play that, the habit is won. Because the habit is growing deeper and deeper roots. And 5 years down the road, it's going to be much, much harder to eradicate than it is now. And on top of all that, on average, people live longer. But there's no one saying that any one of us is guaranteed that we'll be alive a week from now. You know, human life is very fragile. Now, if I were a betting man, I'd say probably there's a pretty high chance that everyone in this room is going to be alive a week from now. You know, it'd be a relatively low probability. But it can happen, and it does happen sometimes. And so just this perspective on, you know, not taking for granted this giant expanse of time in which to do my spiritual practice gives a little more urgency to it. Now, what's very interesting to me is, by contrast to us civilians, or, you know, civilians in the Bay Area, folks in the military, is a culture where they place a high value on discipline. Every aspect of a soldier's life is regulated by discipline. There's a tremendous urgency placed on discipline. And in fact, the reason is, of course, in a moment of crisis, in a moment in the battlefield, if I am undisciplined in that crisis moment, it could cost me my life, or it could cost the life of some of my buddies. You know, so discipline has a life and death importance in the military. What if we gave our spirituality a life and death importance? What if we gave our own spiritual discipline a life and death importance? Now, this idea of using the level of commitment to discipline inherent in the military and applying that to one's spiritual practice, this is the basic idea of a spiritual warrior. And this is actually an ancient idea. You could certainly say that the Bhagavad Gita is one of the earliest expositions of the idea of a spiritual warrior. And that's a text that's, you know, 25 centuries old. One of the most extraordinary, well-developed traditions of the spiritual warrior comes from Japan. It's called the Bushido culture. And so, I actually have a handout. The Seven Virtues of Bushido. And the interesting thing, the Bushido tradition is influenced heavily by the Zen tradition, but it's also influenced quite heavily by Confucianism, which is paradoxical in a way, because Confucianism was a tradition of scholars, and here it is influencing this intense warrior culture. So these are the seven virtues of Bushido, the seven components, you might say, of what it is to be a spiritual warrior, at least in some perspective. And the first one is duty. Now, duty is a word you don't hear too often in New Age circles. Duty is kind of one of these unsexy words, you know? It's a very heavy word. Think about it. What is your duty to yourself? What is your duty to others and to the world? You know, there's not necessarily a clear answer to these questions, but they're questions that you can really drop into and reflect on. You know, what would it mean to view one spiritual practice as a duty? You know, how would that change your relationship to this spiritual practice? The second virtue is courage. I don't know that I'll say a whole lot about this. I think we all know what the word means. I will say that in my view, I think there are few things in life that demand the kind of courage that spiritual work demands. I think it was a quote that a quote from Carl Jung that was on the quote sheet last week. The most terrifying thing in the world is to accept oneself fully. You know, and so there's just tremendous courage, really a warrior's courage, required for spiritual work. Now the next one is Confucius's big idea. It's often translated as benevolence. Sometimes it can be translated as compassion. Ren in Chinese. And this is the, it's sometimes translated as humanity also. It's the good feeling one has in being altruistic. The good feeling one has, the kind of satisfaction one takes in being a giving person. And so it's fascinating that, you know, this kind of quality was seen as essential to a warrior, essential to the samurai. The next one is even more paradoxical. Sometimes it's translated as courtesy or propriety or the rights. And I called this Confucius's innovative concept. Confucius made the claim that he was not an innovator, but this actually was one of his innovations. This character, before Confucius's time, was used exclusively to describe the state of being that people had to have in sacred ritual, in the ancestor worship. So in the sacred ritual, the kind of honoring and reverence people had to have for each other within the context of that ritual was described by this character. Confucius changed the definition. He used this character to talk about all human relationships. So the idea is that any time two human beings are relating, there's an element of the sacred there that needs to have reverenced. And so that's the essential meaning of it. So it's hard to translate as a single word. Courtesy doesn't really capture it. It's, you know, the reverencing of the sacred quality of two human beings meeting. Next one, honesty. Very simple, honesty. How honest are we with ourselves? How would your life be different if you were 100% honest with yourself? You know, would it be different? Would it not be? You know? And what about honesty with others? I mean, obviously there's people that we don't know as well, and we're not going to share our full story with someone we don't know, but are there people, trusted people, with whom you can be fully honest? Because part of that is when you're fully honest with someone you trust, there's the vulnerability that you'll probably get feedback. And, you know, I'm totally honest with somebody. I may be called out on some game that I'm playing with myself, that sort of thing. You know, am I committed enough to the truth to open myself up in that way? The next one, honor. Another one that you don't often hear in a spiritual context. Honor. What does it mean to live with honor? What would it mean to treat yourself with honor? What would it mean to honor your body? What would it mean to honor your living space? What would it mean to honor the people you care about? You know, all profound questions. The word honor, it's a very deep word. And then the last one, loyalty. And loyalty is something certainly that involves commitment. And as I said last week, you know, if you think about interpersonal relationships, you know, if I were to say to somebody, I'm going to be committed to you, but only when I feel like being committed, that's not commitment. Like, that's just not commitment at all, you know? But sometimes that's the quality of the commitment we have to ourselves, you see? What would it mean to be completely loyal to yourself? What would it mean to be completely committed to your well-being? You know, if you think about the commitment of, say, an ideal romantic partner, you know, the commitment that you'd want from an ideal romantic partner, could you have that level of commitment to yourself? You know? And what does it mean if you can't have it to yourself, but you're still expecting it from someone else? You know, like, there's that whole thing. So I'll tell you a samurai story. And this is a good story about duty in many ways. An overlord was killed. He was killed by some kind of criminal, some kind of bad guy. And the samurai, who was in sworn allegiance to this overlord, he had to avenge his master's death. So it took him about a year, and he chased the person down, finally cornered him, and, you know, had him cornered and was about to dispatch with this guy with his samurai sword. And the criminal, you know, just in pure terror, spit in the samurai's face. And the samurai sheathed his sword and walked away. Very paradoxical. You know, our American way of saying is, boy, you know, if he insulted me by spitting in my face, boy, I'm really going to get him now, you know. But that's just it. The samurai's duty, he was fulfilling a duty. He was avenging his master's death. This was an impersonal act. The guy spit in his face, made him mad. But once he was mad, it was a personal act. That's a very different act. He didn't come there to do a personal act. He came there to do an impersonal duty, you know. And so what I like about that story is it's so much about, you know, duty is not just about what we do. It's about the energy and the intention that we bring to what we do. You know, am I being generous purely because I'm generous? Am I being generous because I'm trying to get something from someone? Am I being generous because I want attention or praise? You know, all these sorts of things, you know. Duty is as much in the intention and the energy of the action as in what we concretely do. So on the back, I have a few quotes about the spiritual warrior. The first one is from the guy who invented Aikido. There are no contests in the art of peace. The true warrior is invincible because he or she contests with nothing. Defeat means to defeat the mind of contention that we harbor within. This one from William Feather. If we do not discipline ourselves, the world will do it for us. Chilling and true. I love this short one from Shunryo Suzuki. Discipline is creating the situation. We create the situation for spiritual unfolding by discipline. You know, as our sleeping friend often likes to say, you know, enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes us accident prone. Carlos Castaneda says, to achieve the mood of a warrior is not a simple matter. It is a revolution. To regard the lion and the water rats and our fellow man as equals is a magnificent act of a warrior spirit. It takes power to do that. Jim Rohn says, affirmation without discipline is the beginning of delusion. Great mystic Henry Nouwen says, discipline means to prevent everything in your life from being filled up. Discipline means somewhere you're not occupied and certainly not preoccupied. In the spiritual life, discipline means to create that space in which something can happen that you hadn't planned or counted on. Paul Coelho says, the two worst strategic mistakes to make are acting prematurely and letting an opportunity slip. To avoid this, the warrior treats each situation as if it were unique and never resorts to formulae recipes or other people's opinions. And I'd never heard of this guy, Kilroy Ulster. We're each warriors of our own time. When we step out of our protective shell, we each encounter forces much more powerful than we are. We learn through testing ourselves on the combat zones of our eon. Well, what we learn through testing ourselves on the combat zones of our eon becomes the textbook protocol for how we shall live out the remainder of our lives. The glorious skirmishes and daunting conflicts that we encounter and what we learn from vigorous engagements on the battlefield of time inscribe the story of our lives. Very romantic, exciting perspective there. I love this one from Anton Saint-Martin. Empaths did not come to this world to be victims. We came to be warriors. Be brave. Stay strong. We need all hands on deck. That one is very true. Nikki Rose says, the length of our lives are far shorter than we realize, and half the time, when we become aware of such a truth, we have lived most of it as someone else. So at this point,